I want to begin by offering my gratitude and respects to Dr. S.K. Somaya, by whose insistence it was possible for me to be here today with all of you. As you've heard, this relationship between the Somaya family and ISKCON is something that has happened over several generations. His father, K.J. Somaya, had a very close relationship with Srila Prabhupada, visited him just during his last days in Vrindavan, facilitated the devotees here in Mumbai at a time when it was very difficult to get visas to come to India, and in many ways assisted Srila Prabhupada in a very close manner. And that relationship continued with Dr. S.K. Somaya, his son, who unfortunately has left this world a few days ago, and thus it's a great loss for all of us and for India. So I want to express my thanks, first of all, and my respects to him for what he has done, all the good that he has done, and in many ways made it possible for all of us to be here today. I also want to thank the devotees of ISKCON Chaupati for their as ever, wonderful, incredible hospitality. They've taken care of me in this tour in every little way possible, and I'll be eternally grateful to them for their help. And finally, I want to thank all of you for coming today. I attended the first Prerna Festival. This was April, mid-late April, something like that. And at that time, it was a mind-blowing experience for me. I had never experienced this type of energy before. And I don't know if you remember, but I mentioned that just the three Haribols from all of you would be enough to keep me with prerna for a full year, give me prerna for a full year. And... As it happens, I ended up coming back in less than a year, in not even 6 months. So, and now with so many other Haribols, I don't know what to do with all that surplus prerna. But I'm hoping somehow I can distribute it in some way. All of the prerna that you've given me throughout this tour, which is yet remaining in India and then in other parts of the world. So thank you all very much for having me here. The title of today's presentation is called God and Google, Human Relationships in the Internet Age. It's a topic that's very relevant to today's world, especially to today's youth, and especially in high-tech cities like Mumbai. And so we want to look at this a little more carefully. Now, think of someone who knows everything. Who sees everything, someone who is present everywhere. This person can give you anything you want. Who is this person? Yeah. I know some of you may be old-fashioned thinking of God, right? But... The person I have in mind, of course, is Sri Sri Google. There's actually, if you look to the internet, you can go to churchofgoogle.org. There's actually a church centered around Google. Their religion is officially called Googleism, and they believe that Google is God himself. There they have 9 proofs for the fact that Google is in fact God. Now, if you had to argue for this case, right, that Google is God, what arguments might you be able to give to show that Google is in fact God? Can anyone suggest some arguments? Speak up in favor of Google. Yes, sir. You're on the other side. I'm asking for arguments that Google is actually God. Hey, he's approachable. Anyone can have him, of course, if you have internet access. He's all knowledgeable. Anything you want. One of the primary qualities of God is that he's omniscient, right? He knows everything. And of course, Google knows everything. Anything, anywhere you are in the world, right? Using Google Earth, you can see that place. You can go to that location. Any type of knowledge you want and any little thing you can know as a result of Google. What else? Yes. Ah, it's impartial. Very sophisticated argument, right? Anyone types anything into Google and you're going to get the same results, assuming you do it on the same day at the same time, of course. But otherwise, Google doesn't make a difference between rich or poor. Yes. It knows many languages, right? You can do a search, and not only does it know many languages, but it also gives you the option to translate from one language to another, right? You can translate this page. Very good. What else? Anything else? Yes, it's present everywhere. Anywhere you go in the world, you can find Google. And anything you want from any place in the world, you can get it in Google. You can look up any person in this world, right? Any piece of property, whatever you want. You can find out so many details about my own life, for example. You type it into Google and you can find out all kinds of things, right? So nothing is out of reach with Google. If you need to do research, right, then you don't need anything beyond Wikipedia, right, which is also accessible through Google. If you need a social life, right, you've got things like Facebook and what's the Indian version of Facebook? Orkut, right. You've got that and MySpace and all kinds of places like that, right? If you need to get married, you need entertainment, need medical advice, you can always go over to shadi.com and find the girl of your dreams. Everything is there in Google, right? Google may in fact be God. Well, okay. We know, of course, Google is not God. Why? Can anyone give some arguments for what Google lacks, Google doesn't have? Some arguments in favor of the old-fashioned God, right? Why would Google not be God? Why would you argue in favor of the old-fashioned God? Yes, sir. It's not a person. Okay, very good. Okay, anyway, yes. That's debatable. They've got backup servers in practically every part of the world. Okay, it's not independent, it's dependent on some backup. I think someone in the beginning mentioned electricity, right? That it's dependent on the function of electricity. Of course, if electricity goes out, then Google doesn't die. It's just that we cannot see Google, just like a cloud coming in front of the sun. far in the back there. It only knows what it has been fed with, right? But that's almost unlimited, what it's been fed with, yes. Oh, Google will not listen to your prayers. Actually, that's a very weak argument, right? In fact, Google always answers your prayers. God only answers your prayers sometimes, right? You can pray to God for weeks and weeks and maybe he'll answer. But Google, the minute you put it in, he'll answer whatever it is you want. This is why if you go to that website, Church of Google, then they have the same search field for Google, but instead of search, the button says pray, right? Praying to Google is very effective. In the back there. So you have to ask, right? Otherwise, he won't take care of you. That's a good point. Yes. Google is created, it's not the creator. Excellent. You don't think Google can do Leelas? So many times I've become lost and completely enchanted by Google's leelas. Huh? Yes. Acha, Google doesn't have the six opulences. Maybe that's arguable. Okay, many more hands. Let's take a look at this question a little bit more closely. Okay, a comparison between Google and God. One point: Google, first of all, is ephemeral. Ephemeral means that it's always it's sometimes there and sometimes not there. Whereas God, on the other hand, is eternal. I had a very good friend who, he was an avid Facebook user. He'd spent all his time on Facebook. All his friends, his social life, everyone he knew, all the things he liked to do, everything was on Facebook, this social networking site. And practically his whole life was cataloged on Facebook. One day, you know what happened? Facebook deleted his account. Why? Because he was using it too much. That can happen, you know. They can delete your account for overuse because they think maybe you're, I don't know, spamming or something like that. So they delete, and his whole life was in shatters, right? He didn't know where to turn. All his contacts, all the friends, all the people he knew, his social circle was gone. So much information, knowledge, articles, books, things he had put on these different websites, it was all gone in 1 minute, right? Someone in the Facebook office, they pushed a button and his whole life was in shambles, right? This is the difference between Google and God. Google is constantly in flux. It's changing. Whereas God is stable. If you do a search on Google, one day you'll get one set of results. The next day you do that search again, you may get a completely different set of results. Right? What comes up is always in flux. It's always changing. Not only that, even if you get the same websites, if you click on that website, right, then that website is constantly being updated. We consider this to be a great virtue, that everything is always being updated. Right? My website is constantly updated. This is the whole point behind websites like Twitter. You're constantly updating. This is happening, this is happening. Good organizations, they update their websites all the time. What does that mean? Well, everything's always changing. Right? Nothing's stable. Whereas God, every day you come, Radha Gopinath will be there, and he'll be ready to receive you in the same way. Right? Google is very public in nature. This is one of the biggest current problems with the internet. Is its public nature. This is becoming a big social issue, at least in Western countries. I'm sure in India it'll happen very soon. But what happens is basically you can know so much about someone that they basically don't have a private life. Everything you want, you can know about them, from their income to the properties they own, to the court cases they're part of, to just anything, their likes and dislikes. And for someone seeking popularity, at first, oh, this is a very good thing. Everyone knows everything about me. But eventually it can become very frustrating and also in many cases dangerous. Many crimes are being committed because people can follow Google every step by step by step. They can follow someone's life. This is the case with Twitter, for example. Recently, Twitter has also become something known in India, right? In the news, it's been some politicians been Twittering a lot. This has caused a lot of... So people Twitter, and what does that mean? They update you. I'm here now, I'm going here. And this can, of course, be used by criminals to stalk someone. And there's been cases of kidnapping and so forth as a result of everything being public in people's lives. God, on the other hand, if we so choose, he can be a completely private affair. He's someone who we can know individually, our relationship with him. It doesn't have to be something that anyone else has to know about. Then a big one. Google is impersonal. He's impersonal. Whereas God is eminently personal. This is one of the major problems with what we find on the internet. Internet is becoming something of an addiction for a lot of people. there's a lot of people who cannot do anything without checking their email or without surfing. This becomes so much a part of their life. And they justify it by saying that there's so much information that's out there. Google is full of all kinds of knowledge. And this is good. It's educational. I can learn so many things as a result. But the problem with the information that's found in Google is that it has no source attached to it. The vast majority, 99% of what you find on the internet, it has no source. This is why I work as a professor full-time. Right? I'm teaching students at the university. And we assign them different topics to do research on, and then they have to write essays on that particular topic. And I always tell my students, don't use the internet, please. Why? Because they'll do a search. Suppose they're writing an essay on some topic. Suppose they're writing an essay on yoga, for example. They'll type in the word yoga in Google. The first 10 hits that'll show up, they'll click on them. They'll cut, copy, and paste, put their article together, and they say, wow, now the essay is done. Right? So many good ideas are there. But the problem, you don't know where it's coming from. How many sites do you know where someone will write who the actual author is of the work? What their qualification is? Why anyone should care what they're saying? It used to be unless one had some kind of qualification, some kind of experience in life, something worthy of saying. People would spend a lifetime thinking about a subject, write a book, and that book would become a classic that would be read for years and years afterwards. Now, any fool who has a little bit of something to say can put their ideas on the internet and they have an audience of thousands. Why? Because it's impersonal. It doesn't matter. There's no strings attached to what's there. Right? There's no responsibility associated with it. This is exactly the opposite of how knowledge is described in the Vedic tradition. Knowledge, the Vedas say that more important than the content of knowledge is its source. More important than the content of knowledge is the source of that knowledge. Because if the source is reliable, then you know, even if the content is not complete, you know it'll be good for you. It'll be beneficial for you. Whereas if the source is unreliable, the motivations of the source are not clean, then even it may be factually true, it may be good content, but it can be damaging. It can be harmful. Just like, for example, I may know something about one of you, okay? I know something about your life, I know something about what you like and so forth. I have true or accurate knowledge about you. But I can use that knowledge against you. I can go to someone else and say, do you know he's like this, he's like that? You know what he was saying about you? And so forth. How many times has it been that someone uses their knowledge to put us down, to make us look small, to manipulate us, to create divisions, to rule and divide? Just because you have knowledge, just because you have information or facts, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be good for you. Or good for anyone else, for that matter. The point is, who has that knowledge? What is the source? What are the intentions or motivations of the person leading that knowledge, holding it? On the other hand, if the source is clean, then even if that knowledge is not complete, it'll be beneficial. Just like, for example, a mother. Right. A mother will tell us to do certain things. She may know certain things about the world. Other things she may not know. But when she says something to us, then generally we are able to trust her. Right? We take it seriously. Because we know what she's saying, it's meant for our good. It's beneficial. Her heart is in the right place. So therefore the Vedas always, they talk about, sometimes even in the exchange, like you study the Upanishads, in the exchange between a spiritual master, a guru and a disciple, there won't even be any knowledge, any content communicated. The guru won't say anything. And the disciple will be waiting, oh, when am I going to get knowledge? When am I going to get knowledge? But that doesn't matter, right? The source is there, the knowledge will come. It's inevitable. If you're with the right source, you'll get the knowledge. But just because you have the knowledge doesn't mean that it'll be actually beneficial. This is one of the fundamental problems with the internet or with the knowledge found upon Google, is that it's knowledge without a source. It's content without source. And the whole Vedic system is founded upon the source of knowledge. That's the first thing we have to look at. Right? Arjun first surrenders to Krishna. He explains Krishna's qualifications. Right? Shishyasteham shadhimam tvam praparnam. You're the right person, the source of this knowledge. So I'm asking these questions from you. So, internet comes with no strings attached. Right? Anyone can put anything on the internet. Just recently in the United States, there was a case the government brought upon a criminal case against someone who basically two girls who were in high school, and one was slandering the other on the internet, putting things up on Facebook that was making the other girl look bad. And the situation became so intense that the first girl ended up committing suicide. And the government, for the first time in history, this is a new type of thing, they didn't treat it as a suicide case, but rather as a homicide case, as a case of actual murder. Because of the way that she had been slandered on the internet, the social pressures that had been found there. Right? People feel that they can put anything on the internet, whatever they like. There's no strings attached. Whereas the whole concept of God comes with moral responsibility. Right? God comes with moral responsibility attached as part of the package. You cannot say, I believe in God, and then decide to be irresponsible in one's behavior. That just doesn't work. And the last point, Google can provide us with a lot of information, but that information is not actually knowledge. Because information, ultimately, it has to lead toward transformation. This is the point of education in the Vedic system, is not information, but transformation. This is the point behind gaining knowledge. We have to stop and ask this question. Right? Many times we can be very enamored by what's there, how nothing is out of reach. You can get to know anything. But we have to wait and ask ourselves the question, what is knowledge? What does knowledge constitute? What makes something knowledge? Right? Anyone have any ideas, any clues about that? How would you define knowledge if you have to? What makes something knowledge? Truth. Something is true. What else? Anything else? Something that's universally accepted. Means? Having a proper authority. Good. Something which is useful. Excellent. Very good. Something which has value. Okay. Anything that can answer your questions. Okay. Something that can help us discriminate. Viveka. Something which causes right action. Facts. Someone else said science. Right? So many different ideas of what knowledge is. We all go out seeking for knowledge. So many of us are in university, getting our education. So many of us have just recently completed that. Right? And the whole idea is higher education, gaining knowledge. And yet, so few people have an idea of what knowledge actually is. Right, what constitutes knowledge? Let me offer you a definition of knowledge. This is found in Srimad Bhagavatam. Right? In the second verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, it says, Vedyam vastavamatra vastu shivadam tapatrayon mulanam. Beautiful, beautiful definition. Prabhupada translates it in such an eloquent fashion. He says, reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. This is the definition of knowledge given in Srimad Bhagavatam. Reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. Now, let's look at the first part of this. Reality distinguished from illusion. Right? Most of us, we understand this intuitively. Okay? We understand, okay, if something is knowledge, it has to be real, right? It has to be true, someone said. It has to be factual. It has to actually exist. It has to be something that's universally acceptable. The Vedas say it has to be stable. It's something that's universally accepted. It's true in the past, it's true today, it'll be true into the future. This is what real knowledge is. Other things that are true today, false tomorrow, they may be information. It's something, some useful facts. Actually, the word fact itself, it comes from a Latin which means to make or to create. Right? A fact is something that's created. It's something that's made. It's something that you and I can create. It's not what truth is. It's not what knowledge is. Knowledge is something that is stable. It's reality. It's real. And you have to be able to distinguish what is real from that which is illusory, that which is false. So being able to say, this is true, this is not true, both in a positive and in a negative fashion. Okay, this is the first part of the definition of what knowledge is. Reality distinguished from illusion. Most of us, we can appreciate this. It's intuitively. But the second part is as important. Reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. Shivadam, Shubhadam. It has to be for the welfare of all. In other words, what the Srimad Bhagavatam is saying, that something may be true, but if it causes harm, then it's not knowledge. It may be information, it may be factual, but it's not knowledge if it's not beneficial for people. Right? So these three things. It has to be stable, it has to be factual, right? True, in other words, and it has to be ultimately beneficial. Stable, factual, and beneficial as the definition of knowledge. More and more people are realizing now, in today's scientifically oriented world, that it's not just enough for something to be true. We have to ask the question, how is this going to affect the world? What benefit is it going to have? Will it harm people or will it benefit them? It used to be that scientists, right, they had this feeling that, I'm just doing science. Right? Don't ask me questions about morality or ethics or God. No, that's for the religionists. Go to your temple and ask those questions. I'm doing science. Science, mathematics, these things, they don't have any questions of ethics involved. No, it's true. It's fact. Right? You go to America, you go to India, you go any part in the world, it's going to be still true. It's a fact. I can prove it in the laboratory. And I'm going to discover what there is to discover and throw it out into the world. It's true after all. What people do with it, it's up to them. It's not my responsibility. I'm just a scientist. That's all I'm doing. More and more people are realizing that that kind of attitude doesn't help the world. We've seen the costs of that kind of attitude. Right? Things like global warming, military technology, genetic engineering, nuclear physics, right? Things that our world, problems that our world faces today. All the result of people genuinely seeking knowledge, right? We want to know. Science is all about the search for knowledge. And yet this is what our knowledge produces. Why? Because people refuse to ask the question of value. The question of, is this actually going to be good for someone or not? Just because it's true is not enough. Right? Is it going to be beneficial or not? That's the question. Einstein, he said something very famous. He said, science can tell us how things are, not how they should be. It can tell us how things are, but not how they should be. The question of should has to be a question that is asked side by side. My younger brother, Gopal Haridas, he's doing a PhD right now in Oxford in the topic of science and religion. This is a very new field. It's only shown up in the past 10 years or so. And now all these major universities around the world are starting these departments of science and religion. And before it used to be that you couldn't hear these two words together, right? Science is something that's opposed to religion. Those who are scientists, they're rational thinkers. Those who are religionists, they're emotional. Those who are scientists, they believe in facts. Those who are religionists, they have faith. Right? It was always a contrast between the two. Today, this is a very hot field of study. Everyone's moving. Every publisher in the academic world that's worth their salt has a line of books in science or religion. Why? Because more and more, both sides are realizing, right? The scientists are realizing we have to sit on the same table as religionists. We have to sit on the same table as ethicists and people who know morality. To ask the question, okay, whatever it is I'm discovering, I'm developing, is this going to be good for the world or not? And religionists, theologians, religious people, they're realizing more and more that we can't ignore science anymore. It's one of the most powerful forces in this world. And we have to sit down on the same table and try to find a common ground. So science and religion, finding a synthesis between these two. Right? ISKCON was at the forefront of this kind of activity. Srila Prabhupada, he was at the forefront. He encouraged ISKCON scientists like Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj, Dr. T.D. Singh. Right? They started the first ever conference for the synthesis of science and religion. This happened when? In the 80s maybe? Something like that. And second conference also happened not too long ago in 1997. But this is a very important concern in the world today. What does it mean to actually have knowledge? What is knowledge? Reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. We all, as young people, we go through so many things in life, studying so many different areas, endeavoring for success in so many ways, right? But we should always ask this question. What is the value of what I'm doing? Is it simply true or is it also beneficial? How is it going to actually affect the world in some way? Okay, so this is my incrimination of Google, right? It's one fundamental problem, we can say. Okay, we have nothing against Google in particular, right? It's a good tool. It's very useful. We can use anything in the Lord's service. There's nothing wrong with it, per se. But we should know its limits. Okay? And this is one of those limits. We should not confuse information with actual knowledge. But here's the point. Forget knowledge. Most people who go to Google, they're not looking for knowledge. This is a fact. Most people who do a search on the internet, they're not looking for knowledge. You know what they're looking for? The top five searches on the internet. I want to move to that slide. Here it is. The top five searches on Google during 2009, this year which has just passed. Okay, Michael Jackson, Facebook, 20, which is a Spanish networking site like Facebook or Orkut, Twitter, which is again a networking site, and this one, Sanalika, right? Turkish. It's a Turkish social networking site. What are people looking for on the internet? They're not looking for knowledge. What are they looking for? Relationships. People are looking for relationships. The internet is supposed to make us always connected, right? Always in touch. You remember the days of the internet when there used to be this funny sound? This sound used to come, the sound of connecting, and then you were connected to the internet, right? Some people may still be using that kind of connection, a dial-up connection. And then you were in touch. You were connected with the world. That's now outdated, right? You can have broadband internet. You're connected constantly, immediately. You don't even need to be at your computer. You can have it on your mobile phone. Anywhere you're going, you can be connected to the internet. We're always connected and we're always in touch. And yet the irony of the situation is that the more people are connected, the more they're in touch. The more they become isolated. The more they become out of touch. The more they search for relationship. We live in a world which is becoming more and more fractured. People are seeking everywhere you go in the world. Everywhere you go, people are looking to connect with others, not with computers, not with information or knowledge. There's enough of that in the world. Too much, in fact, information. It's information overload. That's not what people are looking for. They're looking for relationship. That's what they're searching for. And that is the one thing that Google cannot provide, is relationship. This many analysts, they talk about that these social networking sites are basically the limit of what the internet has to offer. They can connect you to people, but they cannot create relationships. They cannot create relationships. It's relationship that we're searching for in this world. How many times do you find two people? I've seen this many times. Two people walking, friends walking down the street. They've obviously decided to spend the evening together. And they're talking about something. In the meantime, one person's mobile phone will ring. And he'll pick up his mobile, start talking. Yeah, I'm with a friend, I'm here. Yeah, I'm just coming, I'm around the... Then, in the meantime, the other person is feeling a little left out, right? So he pulls out his mobile phone and starts doing something, right? And, oh, I'm not getting any call. Why isn't anyone calling me, you know? And then they'll dial something. Okay, I better call someone. And then they're... Two friends walking down the street decided to spend the evening together. And what are they doing? They're each talking to someone else in some other place, deciding on the next time to meet, because they cannot actually enjoy the time they've got to meet right there. It's a fact. I see this so much with my own students, right? The ways in which the internet, the technology is making us socially incapable. Where people don't know, students today don't know how to maintain a simple conversation. A conversation with someone who's not their good friend. Right? Someone they meet for the first time. Something we call small talk. They don't know how to keep that up. How to maintain it. How to ask questions. How to create that kind of relationship. As soon as they're with someone, they say a few, oh, hello, hi. And then there's an awkward silence, and both people will pull out their mobile phones and they'll start punching something in it, right, in order to get out of that awkward situation. You see this now more and more also with Indians. All these highly trained software programmers who come from India to the United States on contract with different kinds of companies. Right? Same thing. Same thing. You see that more and more and more. That the socially oriented culture of India is being replaced by this disconnectedness born of technology, right? The lack of social relationships. And we find that human need. It's so essential to us. Relationship. Where can we find that? Of course, we know. Our claim is that that relationship that we're seeking, that sambandha, right, that relationship of love, can only ultimately be found in God. It can only be ultimately found in Krishna. Some relationship that can actually satisfy the soul. Savai pungsang paro dharmo yato bhaktir adhokshaje ahaitokya pratihata yayatma suprasidati. By which that type of relationship by which a person can be truly satisfied. Yato bhaktir adhokshaje. That relationship can be found in the Supreme Lord, God Himself only. Now, one could say, you could argue, well, okay, I've heard this many times, right? Google, you say you cannot have relationships because, okay, he's abstract. Google cannot, you can't have, connect with Google, and you can't really see Google and this and that, and it's ephemeral and always unstable and this and that. But God is like that too, right? God is also so abstract. You can't see God also. How am I supposed to have a relationship with God? Right? We can say that God is the source of all relationship. But what does this mean practically? I don't see, I cannot find any way of relating with God. So let's look at the other side of the equation a little more carefully. So far we spent our time with Google, right? Pointing out the flaws, the shortcomings in Google. Okay, fine. Now let's look at the other side, God. We have to ask the question, first of all, a very basic question. What is God? Who is God? How can we define what God is? If someone asked you for a definition of what God is, just as I asked you a definition of what knowledge is, right? If you had to define what God is, or you asked someone on the street what God is, right? How might they answer a question like that? What would they say? Anyone? Any suggestions?
A creator.
The creator, right? Very, very common. All powerful, right? Independent. Omnipresent. Supreme Personality. The source of all that there is. All powerful. All merciful. All pervading. All opulence. All attractive. Wow, you guys are good at this. Huh? What? The? Wealthiest. Unlimited. Enjoyer. All kinds of different qualities we can come up with God. Ramanujacharya, he called Kalyana Guna Sagara. Right? He's the ocean of all kinds of wonderful good qualities. If you talk to the person on the street, one thing you might hear, a very basic concept of God, that nature is God. The world is God. Right? God is there in everything. Everything is God. You might hear this a lot. God is nature. This concept is called pantheism. Pantheism means the idea that nature is God. Okay. This, according to the Vedas, this is the first level of understanding of what God is. It's a pantheistic conception. Everyone knows the world. We look around. And we are so much in awe of the world, we say, this is who God is. Someone who's a little bit more advanced, they say, God is the world, but God is also more than the world. He's all-powerful. He's the supreme power, the supreme energy, present everywhere. He's the force that exists. They might say, God is love, God is power, God is light. This is the next level, an impersonal concept of what God is. Right? From pantheism to impersonalism. That God is present everywhere, God is in all things, God is the supreme power, the supreme energy. If you come to someone who has a little bit of a higher concept of God, then they might say, God is not just abstract energy, He's not just abstract power, but He is actually a person. He is not just power, but He is powerful. He is not just energy, but He is the energetic Himself as well. And they have a personal concept of God. That God is my Father. That God is the Creator. That God is my Judge. That God will give me anything I want if I pray to Him. In this way, people interact with God on a personal basis. And this is so common. In India, you can go to the West, anywhere in the world. People worship God as the Creator. Shrishtikarta, Jagatkarta, they say, the creator of this world. But the question that the Srimad Bhagavatam asks, the crucial question, is when God is not related or connected to this world, when He's not busy taking care of you, then what is He doing? Who is God in Himself? Sometimes we think, oh, I called God Shrishtikarta, Jagatkarta. Bhagavan sab kuch ke karta hai. We think, wow, I've done God a great favor by calling Him this. That, oh, He's the creator. He's the source of everything. This is the highest thing possible that we can call God. Is the source of everything that exists. Yes, that's true. But that's only a minor part of what God is. Because after all, why would He want to spend His time creating this world? Creation is a difficult job. It's hard work. If any of us have created or invented something, you know it's a lot of hard work to create something, to produce something. Even more work to maintain it. And also a lot of work to destroy it or wrap it up. Why would God want to spend all His time doing all that work? You know, at the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Krishna, Vishnu, He gives instructions to Lord Brahma. Brahma is the creator of this world. He has four heads by which He can supervise everything in this creation. And Brahma, when He comes out of the lotus flower upon which He's born, He's all confused. He doesn't know what to do. He meditates for 100 celestial years. And as a result, He gets darshan of the Lord Himself. Srimad Bhagavatam says that He sees the entire spiritual world. Who Krishna is, He sees the Lord, all His energies, He sees the spiritual world, everything, He has darshan. when he has darshan, he offers these beautiful prayers to the Lord. We know these prayers, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. We sing them every morning. After he's finished offering these prayers, you know what the Lord does? You know what he does? How he greets him? He comes up and he shakes his hand. He says, O Lord Brahma, Bhadram Te, good luck to you. Right? From one creator to another, I know this is a tough job. So, I've given you the knowledge, now good luck. I'm off to do what? Play. Right? I'm off to have a good time. Good luck to you. Right? He delegates the task. Anyone who's a good manager, who's a good leader, right? They don't spend their time micromanaging. They delegate. Creation, you take care of it. Maintenance, you take care of it. Destruction, you do it. You want to do the rains, the light of the sun and the moon, okay, you can take care of it. Indra can take care of this. Varuna can take care of this. Agni can take care of this. Everyone's got their different departments. They can all take care of this. What does God, he spend his time doing? Leela. Right? Leela means play. Play, this is all. Right? Sport, having fun, enjoying, pastime. If you look around in the world, it's so rare to find a concept of God like this. Everyone, they define God in their own terms. What is God good for me? Right? What will he do for me? Just like this bhajan, Om Jai Jagadisha Hare. Right? Sukha Sampatti Ghara Aave. Right? Let happiness, let wealth come to me. Huh? It's nice. We should go to God for all these things. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing bad. Right? God does that too. But if he had a choice, what would he spend his time doing? Right? When he's not doing all of this, when he's not functioning as the judge and the creator, and the, when he's not at his job, when he goes home, what does he like to do? How does he spend his time? Leela, play. This is why we define God as Leela Purushottam. Srila Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he defines nectar devotion, he defines Krishna as Akhila Rasamrita Murti. Akhila Rasamrita Murti. He who is the complete reservoir, the complete embodiment of all relationships. Any kind of relationship that you want in this world, you can find it in Krishna. You can find it in God. This is who God is. Yes, he's all powerful. Yes, he's all knowing. Yes, he's the wealthiest. Yes, he's the strongest. But what is he going to do with all that wealth? What is he going to do with all that strength? Right? He uses all of that just to please his devotees. Just to have good relationships with his devotees. This is all. Because devotees, they want certain kinds of relationships. And any kind of relationship you're searching for in this world, you can find it in Krishna. You're looking for a real father, a real mother. You can find this in Krishna. He says, Mata Dhata Pitamaha. He says, Pitaham Asya Jagata, Mata Dhata Pitamaha. He says, Pitaham Asya Jagata, I'm the father of this whole creation. But also he says, Mata, I'm the mother also. Because a father and a mother's love, it's different, no? A father loves in one way, a mother loves in a different way. We need both. Sometimes we want a father's love. Sometimes we want a mother's love. Krishna says, I'm the father of this creation. Ah, but also Mata. Mata, Dhata, Pitamaha. Oh, and besides the love of mother and father, there's also the love of grandparents. It's different altogether. The parents, they're a little more strict. The grandparents, they give you anything. So Krishna's saying, you want that kind of love? Come to me. You want a father's love? Come to me. You want a mother's love? Come to me. You want an employer's love? Whatever that is, you come to me. Right? Any kind of love you want. Right? You can come to me, I'll give it to you. He says, yoga kshema vahamyam, right? I'll be the best boss. I can give you anything you want. Right? You want that, you come to me. Artho jignyasurarthati jnanir cha bharatarshava. Krishna says, you're in need of money, make me your boss. I'll be your employer. I can give you whatever you want. Right? Any kind of relationship you're looking for in this world. Right? You look at our whole life. Look at it from start to finish. Right? It's a search for relationship. Look at the small baby. As soon as it's born, what does it do? It cries. What is it crying for? Its mother. Right? As soon as the mother puts the child to her breast, he's happy. Right? The sambandha, the relationship is there. I have someone. At that point, he doesn't even know who the father is. He just knows mother is there. Then it says the relationship between mother and father develops. A child's eyesight as a baby, they're very nearsighted, babies when they're born. The distance they can see clearly, you know how far it is? It's about this much. This is all they can see clearly. Beyond that, the whole world is a blur. This is all they need, right? This is the distance that a mother or father holds the child. And the child can see the mother, the father carefully, and they develop a relationship. Then they grow a little bit older. The child grows older, and he starts searching for what kind of relationship then? Friends. Where are friends? They want people to play with, right? A small child, 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe up to the 10th, 12th year, they're all interested. Where are my friends? I want to go out to play cricket or play some sports or go to the movies, do something with my friends. That's exciting. And then a certain age arrives, and what are they looking for? Oh, girls, right? Girls. Relationship with the opposite sex. Where's the princess of my dreams? Right? Who's going to be my heroine? And she's thinking, who's going to be my hero? Who's going to be that knight in shining white armor? Right? Who's going to come and take me away? Right? We all come to this world. We all come to this world with this conception. Right? That I'm the prince and you're the princess. Right? This is our whole... We come to every living entity in this world. Human beings, dogs, cats, everyone is thinking in this way. Right? That's... I'm the king. Hum raja hai, tum rani ho. I'm the Rajkumar, you're the Rajkumari. And every Rajkumar is looking, where can I find my Rajkumari? And every Rajkumari is thinking, where can I find my Rajkumar? This is the whole story behind every Bollywood film, right? It's just looking for that same thing. It's the same story, rehashed over and over again. Right. There was once an American friend I had. He likes Indian culture a lot and this and that. He's always hanging out with Indians. And one time they invited him to a Bollywood film, to watch a film, basically. There was a screening in our town. This was a big event for the Indian community because normally you don't get to watch Hindi films on the big screen, you know, except if you're in very big cities. So he showed up there. And during the intermission, during the break in between, right, he was talking to someone, they said, how do you like it? He said, oh, it's excellent, very good. And he told the rest of the story. And they said, oh, you already seen the film? He said, no, I haven't seen the film. How did you know? Right? It's the same story. It's the same story over and over again. Why? Because it's the story that we come to live in this world. This is the story that we're all dying to live. Right? That I want to be the king, you can be my queen. And this is the story of every fairy tale. You listen to every fairy tale in this world. Right? There's some prince and there's some princess. You look at Cinderella, you look at Snow White, anyone. And they end up finding each other and they ride off into the sunset to live happily ever after. The question that no one asks is what happens after they ride into the sunset. Right? That's where the real story of relationships begins, right? Up to the point of the marriage, everything is a fairy tale. What happens after that? There's the relationship, right? But no one asked that question. Maybe Cinderella got divorced. How do you know, right? So we go through this world searching for that kind of relationship, that fairy tale, living in this fairy tale. But the only real fairy tale in this world is the fairy tale found in Vrindavan, right? Where Krishna is. Where Krishna, he's the playboy. He's the hero of everyone's lives, right? All the mothers of Vrindavan, they're crazy after him. He's everyone's best friend. And he's the boy, the apple of every girl's eye, Right? It's Krishna who lives that fairy tale, and everyone in Vrindavan who's able to live that fairy tale. In this world, we can't find it. The way the world is set up, it's made to shatter every fairy tale. Right? Because just think about it. If I'm thinking I'm the king, and you're thinking you're the king, how many kings can there be? Right? In one room. As long as you live in your world and I live in mine, you have your house and I have my house, then things are okay. As long as there's some overlap, as long as there's some shortage of resources, then all that, it finishes immediately. Then it's one against the other. Right? And this is how we see in this world. It's full of conflicts. Why? As long as there's enough to go around. Right? There's enough plates to go around, then everyone can have their share. But what if there's only one plate? What if there's only one mango? Who's going to have it? Me or you? Well, I'm thinking I'm the king. You're thinking you're the king. And this becomes the cause of conflict in this world. But the nature of Krishna, is that he can be everything to everyone at the same time. This is how wonderful he is. You see, in relationships in this world, there's two problems. There's two major problems. One is, we can't get along with everyone. There's all kinds of personality types, personality matches in this world. I'm sure you must know people in your own lives. People you just can't stand. Right? You can't handle them. Their approach to the world. Maybe you're a very slow and steady person, they're hyperactive. Maybe you're a very active person, they're too slow and you get frustrated. Maybe they're too emotional and you don't like that. You're more rational. Maybe you're very sentimental, you cry at every small thing and they're too rational. Whatever it is, we've all got different natures in this world, right? This is why before marriage, they try to match all these qualities. Look at this one, this one, this one, this one, and this one matches. And so many match, okay, then this has marriage has some chance of working out, right? we're limited, right? We can't get along with everyone. That's the first issue. The second issue, even with those people we can get along with in this world, how many can we actually have a relationship with? 5, 6, 10? How many people do you have a real relationship? Not just people you've got in your mobile phone, their numbers. No. Actual people you've got a relationship. How many? Maybe 10, 15, 20? 40, 50 at maximum? Right? Even that's too much. We give so much to someone, right? And we become stretched thin in another direction. Right? How many directions can we be pulled? The wife, she wants something. The kids, they want something. The parents, they want something else. Our boss, they want something else. Right? How many people can we satisfy in this life, in this world? If we give 25%, if I give 25% to you, how much do I have left for someone else? 75%. And I hand myself out to varying degrees. And people, they become overwhelmed. And this is one of the major causes of stress in the world today. I'm stretched thin. Right? There's too many commitments, too many responsibilities. I can't handle, keep up with all my relationships to everyone. And people complained, you haven't called, it's been so long. Right? Yeah, I couldn't call, I was so busy. Right? How many people can we keep up with? But Krishna, he can keep up with every single person all the time. He is such that he doesn't have either one of these problems. He is able to have a relationship with every person, every personality type he can have a relationship with. And you see in his lifetime, he had relationships with every kind of person. You're looking for relationships of parental love, he had that. Of conjugal love, he had that. Married love, he had that. Unmarried love, he had that. You look at relationships with servants or with friends, he had that. Any kind of personality. There were people in Krishna's lives who were very sentimental, very emotional. He had a very nice relationship with them. People who are powerful warriors like Bhima and Bhishma. And he had such a wonderful relationship with them. Virya rasa, right? The relationship of chivalry. He had relationships with even people like Shishupal and Dantavakra and these demons, right? They also enjoyed fighting with Krishna. Every type of personality or nature Krishna can have a relationship with. You know what that means? It means that every kind of personality Krishna has. In Krishna's own personality, there's every... Krishna is so multifaceted. We have one kind of personality. Krishna has every kind of personality within him. You're looking for someone who's always jolly and funny, a comedian. Maybe that's your type. Well, who can be funnier than Krishna? He's always cracking jokes. He's the funniest person in Vrindavan. Maybe the comedian is not your type. You want a more tragic figure, right? Then who can be a more tragic figure than Krishna himself? He left Vrindavan at the age of 12 years and left everyone pining there, right? Suffering in his absence. He's the king of tragedy. If you're looking perhaps for someone who's serious, who's responsible, a married man type, right? You look at Krishna in Dwaraka. He was able to satisfy every one of his 16,000 queens and live the life of an ideal grihastha. Maybe that's not your type. Maybe you're looking for someone who's a good friend, or someone who's a little child. Right? Whatever your type is, whatever you want in your list of relationships, you can find that type in Krishna. He has every personality type. He's personality type A, B, C, D, everything. Right? It's there in him. And then number two, he has time for everyone. Just because he has a good relationship with Krishna doesn't mean, oh, Krishna's now given him 50%, there's only 50% left for you. Right? The quality of Krishna is that if he gives 100% to you, how much does he have left for you? 100%. The Upanishads say, Purnam adaha purnam idam purnat purnam udachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnam eva avashishyate. Right? Purnasya purnamadaya. When you take 100% away from the complete, the whole, you take everything away from that which is whole, how much is left? 100% only. This is the mathematics of the spiritual world. Right? 100%, you take away from 100%, what you've got left is still 100%. Right? Every cowherd boy in Vrindavan, you know what he thinks? Every cowherd boy? He thinks, I don't know what I've done to deserve the fact that Krishna considers me to be his best friend. Right? Krishna, there's so many boys around here. And Krishna, he thinks of me as his best friend. Why? I can't understand. I'm so lucky. Right? Every cowherd boy, the next one also, is thinking the same thing. Now, is Krishna cheating everyone? Is he fooling everyone? You know, like a playboy telling one girl, oh, I'm yours completely. Then going to the next one saying, main tumhara hu. Right? Is Krishna doing like that? No. It's really, in this world, we can only have one best friend. That's the meaning of best. Best means one. First means one. Right? The Guinness Book of World Records, it only has one in each category. Right? Otherwise, how can it be? You cannot have five people who are the fastest people in this world and five people who are the strongest. No. One in this world. But Krishna, he can be your best friend and your best friend and my best friend and everyone's best friend. Right? We can be Krishna's favorite, every single person. When Krishna does the Rasa Leela, then every gopi is thinking that how is it that Krishna decides to dance next to me? There's so many gopis here, but Krishna is dancing just next to me only. Every queen in Dwaraka, she's thinking, 16,000 of them, they're all thinking, Krishna is so kind, he's spending all his time with me. And is Krishna doing that? Yes, of course. There's 16,000 Krishnas. There's one Krishna between every gopi. There's a Krishna for every cowherd boy. And there's a Krishna in every one of our hearts. He's there. He's there waiting for us to have a relationship with him. Waiting for us to wake up to that fact that we go through this whole lifetime searching for relationships. Right? As a baby, we need our parents. As older, we need friends. We get a little older, we need a husband or wife. We get yet older, and we need children. We want to be parents. We get a little bit older, and we're pushing them. Why don't you get married now? Right? We want a bahu, and we want this and that in our house. Right? And then, a little bit older, kab bache karoge? Right? When am I going to get grandkids? Right? Every stage of life, we're looking for relationships. And yet we don't realize that the person that we can have a relationship with is next to us the whole time. He's always there. He's always there. He's always approachable. Waiting for us to have a relationship of any kind, whatever kind of relationship we want, He can give us. This is why it's so urgent, it's so important to practice spiritual life. Right? It's so important to try to develop that relationship with Krishna. Because like any relationship, it's not going to come on a plate. Right? No relationship is born like a fairy tale. Right? That's not how relationships are made. Every relationship, we know it requires work. If you have a good friend and you want to keep that friend, you have to do something about it. You have to call that person up every once in a while. Maybe go out to do something, share a meal together. If you want to maintain your relationship with your wife or your husband, you have to work for that. Right? Same thing with God. Yes, Krishna can give us any relationship we want. But if we want a relationship with Krishna, we have to work for it. Krishna wants to see that we actually have some time for Him. Not just, oh, Krishna, you're there, you're everything to me. Right? But then we don't have any time for Him. We don't do anything for Him. No, we have to make this a priority in life. Just like parents, they make their children a priority, right? No matter how busy a father may be or a mother may be, they take time out for their children. They come home from work, they take time out for their children. We have to take time out for Krishna and make that a priority in our lives. That no, this is the most important relationship. Because it will last me forever. When every other relationship in this world is long gone, then this relationship is the one that will stay with me. And yet, this is the very relationship that we ignore. It's a relationship that we leave last for our day. After we've finished everything, then if we have some times, oh, I still have so many rounds left, let me go chant them. Right? Or still I have to do this, or I have to do that. Maybe let me go to the temple. Our most important thing, it comes the last on our priority list. This is the great unfortunate aspect of the situation. This is the tragedy of today's relationships. Is we look for relationships in every place, in every way. And yet the person who can give us that relationship, we don't have time for him. We cannot make time for him. I'll just end with a very beautiful verse. This verse is spoken by Maharaj Kulashekhara. Right? He was one of the Alvars of South India, a great Acharya in the Sri Vaishnava tradition. He says, Srila Prabhupada, he was very fond of Maharaj Kulashekhara's prayers. You know, he used to recite them a lot in his private time. In one particular verse, his beautiful, beautiful statement he has. He says, Ma bhi manda mano vichintya bahudha yamishchiram yatana. Ma bhi manda mano vichintya bahudha yamishchiram yatana. Naivami prabhavanti paparipava swami nanu shridhara. Alasyam vyapaniya bhakti sulabham dhyayaswanarayanam. Lokasya vyasanapano danakaro dasasya kimnakshama. And he says, Ma bhi mandamano vichintya bahudha. He's speaking to his mind, right? This verse is addressed to the mind. Oh, slow mind, oh, stupid mind, he says, mandamana. Ma bhi, why are you so worried? Why are you full of anxiety? Why are you so stressed out in this world today? Right? All of us were so full of anxiety about every little thing in this world. Right? Ma bhi, don't worry, don't fear. Perhaps you're afraid. Mabhi manda mano vichintya bahuda yamish chiram yatana. Maybe you're thinking of all the sins you've committed and all the suffering that you have to get. Maybe you're worried this problem may come, that problem may come in your life. He says, Naivami prabhavanti paparipava. All your hosts of sins, they cannot affect you. They will not affect you. Why? Swami Nanu Sridhara. Don't you remember that your master is Sridhara? Sridhara means the Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, Lord Vishnu, Narayana. Right? Your master is the Lord of Lakshmi herself. And you're worried about all these little problems. Swami Nanu Sridhara. The word Nanu in Sanskrit means, like in Hindi we say, Aapke Swami to Bhagavan Krishna hai, hai na? It's this henna, nanu in Sanskrit. Swami Nanu Sridhara, he's arguing with his mind. Don't you know? And have you forgotten? It seems that you have forgotten. So then he says, Alasyam vyapaniya bhakti sulabham dhyayasva narayana. Give up your alasyam, your laziness, right? Your lethargy. We become so lazy in matters of spiritual life. In everything else, we'll have so much ambition. I have to study hard and get the best marks. I have to work hard and please my boss. Right? I have to move up to this position in the world. I have to make money and this and that and so forth. In everything, we're heroes, right? But when it comes to spiritual life, we're lazy. He says, Alasyam vyapaniya. Give up your laziness. Bhakti sulabham dhyayasva narayana. And worship, meditate on Lord Narayana. Why? Bhakti sulabham. He's so easily achieved by bhakti, by devotion. It's not even difficult. And all he's looking for is a little bit of relationship from our side. That's all. Bhakti means relationship. That's all he's looking for. We're looking for relationship. Krishna's looking for relationship. Everyone's looking for the same thing. It's a good match. Bhakti sulabham. He says, then the final line is very nice. He says, Lokasya vyasana pano dhanakaro. Dasasya kimna kshama. That Lord Sridhara, he's destroying the problems, he's taking away the misery of every person in this world, every living entity. Lokasya vyasana apano dhanakaro. He's helping every creature in this world, giving them what they need to live. Whether they worship him or not, he doesn't care. He helps everyone. Prabhupada used to say that the elephant, he gets his 100 pounds of food to eat. And the ant, it gets its one grain. Only man has an economic problem. Right? Right. Krishna, he's giving everyone to everything to everyone in this world. Lokasya vyasana apano dhanakaro. Dasasya kim nakshama. Then what will he not give for someone who is his own servant? You become the Lord's servant and you think he won't take care of you? He's taking care of this whole creation and he'll let his servant, the one who's trying to develop a relationship with him, he'll let him just suffer like that? No. No. What is he not ready to do for his servant? Dasasya kim nakshama. There's nothing he cannot do for his devotees. And this is why he's called Bhakta Vatsala. Right? So this is the key to relationship. Right? The choice between God and Google, it's there. Right? Google is very useful. It can be a very helpful tool. But only when it's used in the service of God. Right? When it's used to further relationships, not to separate us. And God, yes, he's also a very good thing. But we have to know who God is. We have to be able to define him properly. If we just define him in any way other than Akhila Rasamrita Murti, Lila Purushottama, right, then we'll be dissatisfied. We won't find that satisfaction. We can treat him as our order supplier. We can treat him as our master. We can treat him as our creator. All those are, again, very good things. Nothing wrong. But ultimately, if we're looking for true satisfaction, then it's going to be found in Krishna. Right? The Leela Purushottam. It's going to be found in God, who is the source of all relationships. We have to understand Him as a person, as the source of all relationships. So, I'm going to stop at that point, at this point, conclude here. If there's any questions, comments, ideas that you might have, then please feel free at this point. We still have a little bit of time. Yes, sir, in the back. Okay. I can repeat questions if that's easier. What is the importance of Facebook or Orkut in a devotee's life? Honestly, I cannot say because I've never used it myself either. So, my brother, he has a Facebook site, so he might be able to tell a little bit better. I know many devotees who use it to connect devotees with each other, right? Create a situation where devotees can have each other's association. I know there are many devotees in different parts of the world who are very, very isolated. They don't have any sadhu sangha. Here we're very fortunate, of course, that we have so much sadhu sangha. But there's many devotees who are living, especially in Western countries, places like the United States and so forth, such vast countries, and the numbers of devotees relatively are much smaller. The number of temples are much smaller. And so I knew one particular family who was living in the state of Kentucky in the United States. This is a very, very isolated place. For years he was living there. Because of work and personal needs, he had to live there. Right? And IsconDesiretree.com was his lifeline. Right? He would live off of it practically because it was the only source of association he ever had. Right? Every morning program he would do on IsconDesiretree.com. Evening program he would do there. Afternoon program he'd do there. Everything he'd do. Festivals he'd celebrate there. So it was very useful for him. Very nice. So in some ways it can be, as you see, this world, as it becomes more and more mobile and diversified and disconnected, so sometimes these things, they become useful to reconnect. The fact of the matter is that people are being far flung. They're going to places much farther away from their communities than they ever had. Right? People, they never used to travel very far outside the village. Maybe to the neighboring village. Even when someone got married, if they went to a few villages down, it was a big thing, you know. But basically, people stayed in their communities. These days, the world has changed. Right? Everyone's going in all over the place in different directions. These things, then, in order to solve the problems created by modern civilization, then some of these tools may be useful also. And so some use may be like that. Good question. What else? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Philosophically, we all know that our real position is to serve Krishna.
Right.
Philosophically, we all know that we all have an eternal relationship with Krishna. But then the thing is that the tendency of, you know, this thing, forgetting that and not keeping such things in mind, not getting realizations, that doesn't happen at times. Like, I mean, the thing is that, like, I keep telling to myself, okay, whatever I have to do for the service of Krishna. But right. Still, there are a lot of things which are very important, but I miss.
Right. Yeah. This is why it's so important that we maintain our daily practice of sadhana. Right? This process that Srila Prabhupada gave us of 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna Mahamantra every day, maintaining the four regulative principles, associating with devotees, attending the morning program. Right? The whole point of this is that if we begin our day in the right way, then the rest of the day we have a better chance of remembering Krishna. Right? My spiritual master, he says that if you attend the full morning program, this includes Mangalarti, Japa, Guru Puja, chanting our rounds, listening to Srimad Bhagavatam, and eating Krishna Prasad for breakfast. Right? If you attend the full morning program, you can do any damn thing you please. Right? And Krishna will take care. He will. Right? Because the point is, we've taken out time for Him. Many times people say, oh, you know, why do I have to chant the holy name? Why do I have to chant Hare Krishna? Why do I have to do a certain number of rounds? I'm always remembering Krishna. Din bhar mere ghar mein bhajan chalta rehta hai, and I always remember Krishna. And always I'm thinking about Krishna. You know, why do I have to do this? Because everything we do in this world, yes, Krishna may be involved in it, but there may be also some selfish motive there also. Perhaps you're listening to bhajans of Krishna, but are you listening to it because it's the holy name or because it's nice beat, right? It's nice music. The tabla is going very nicely, or some famous singer is singing the bhajan, or perhaps it's some kind of filmy rhythm, right? How do you know? You're cooking food at home to offer to Krishna. But also you're thinking, oh, what will the kids like to eat, or what will the husband like to eat, or what will the wife like to eat? Right? There may be selfish motive involved in everything. But chanting, doing our japa every day is one thing where there's no scope for that. Krishna knows that the reason this person is doing this is just for me. This is my time with Krishna. Who are you going to show off in front of? Right? What are you going to get from it? No, this is my time with Krishna. That type of time we all have to take out in our lives. Times when we're not doing anything else. This is my time with Krishna. Then Krishna, he appreciates that a lot. He says, okay, this person took out time for me. Now I'll make time for him. Right? I'll take care of whatever else there is in life. And then during the course of our day, yes, we can remember Krishna in whatever way possible. Right? That's good. But we stand a better chance if we give some exclusive time to Krishna. That's the key. And then gradually the influence of that time we have with Krishna, it'll spread through the rest of our lives. Right? We'll find that we're remembering Krishna more and more and more. They did some kind of survey in which they found that the average worker, when they're for a desk job, when they're sitting in front of a computer, their mind goes to something else other than their work. And an average of like 10 or 12 times per minute. Right? Our mind will go from one place. We might think, oh, I have to get home at this time, or what's for dinner today, or this or that. We might think of so many different things. An average of 10 times it moves in 1 minute to things other than what we're working on. Why can we not take the mind to Krishna those 10 times? Right? People sometimes say, oh, you know, if I think of Krishna a lot, then I won't be able to do my work. That's not a fact. Right? Most of the time you're not doing your work anyway. Right? You're spending your time doing other things. It's just an excuse. We choose to think of other things. But we can think of Krishna if we want. This is what he tells Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, right? Ma manusmara yudhyacha. Fight. You don't think fighting requires concentration? Right? No, it's the most concentrated activity. One moment's delay, right? One moment's misjudgment, you could be dead the next moment. Right? Who of us have a job like that? Right? No one. Right? That was Arjuna's job. One moment and he could be killed. You don't think that required concentration? But still Krishna said, Ma manusmara yudhyacha. Think of me and do your work. It is possible to do both at the same time. It is possible. Our mind can multitask. Most of the time, it does multitask. Right? It does think of 100 things at once. Right? But Krishna is never one of them. Why? Right? This is what we have to practice. This is abhyasa. Krishna says, abhyasa yoga yuktena. By the process of practice, we can get the mind to focus on Krishna. And that practice begins with our daily sadhana every day. What else? Other questions? Yes, sir. Hare Krishna. Right. Okay, so it's a good question. On the one hand, Krishna delegates everything, but on the other hand, how can he say that he has time for everyone? You see, it's a fact. Krishna does delegate everything. But the one thing he does not delegate is taking care of his own devotees. That's something that he will do with his own hand. This is why he delegates everything else, is so that he has time for his devotees. Right? Just like there's one story of Akbar and Birbal. Perhaps you've heard this story before. That Akbar, one time he was telling Birbal, why is it, Birbal of course is a Hindu, Akbar was not. He said, why is it that your God is always running down to earth as avatar? Any little thing and he comes down to earth. Right? Why can he not just do it? Why can't not he delegate? Right? Do it for someone else. And Birbal said, okay, I'll explain. Right? And this was always Birbal's style. He'd never give a straight answer. He said, you'll see one day. So one day there was a big, beautiful boat festival happening in his court. It was like the courtroom, he was on his throne, and the whole area down below was covered with water. And in this way, the people were singing and dancing and music, and the boat was floating everywhere. And Birbal had everything prearranged. The lady, the nanny who was taking care of Birbal's infant child, not infant, but small child, she accidentally dropped the child into the water. Accidentally, the child fell into the water. It was not an accident, of course, but she fell into the water. You know what happened? Before anyone, any of his courtiers or ministers or soldiers, everyone was there. Before anyone could get to the child, the king was off his throne and into the water to pick up the prince and to get him out. And Birbal, he said, what are you doing, Maharaj? You're the king. There's so many people here to take care of you. Why you come down? Stay there peacefully. We'll get the child for you. And Akbar said, what, you crazy? This is my kid. This is my boy. I'm just supposed to sit there and watch him drown? No, I can't do that. And he said, this is the way our Lord is. Right? This is the way Krishna is. When Prahlad Maharaj, right, he's suffering. He's just a 5-year-old boy. Of course Krishna can send someone down to kill Hiranyakashipu. What does it take? For him, he's the most powerful. He can send a bolt of lightning from the sky and he'd be dead. Right? But no, he comes himself to take care of the child. Not because to kill Hiranyakashipu, but to take care of Prahlad. That my boy is suffering, I have to protect him. Right? When Dhruva Maharaj is suffering, Krishna will show himself, he'll come down himself to take care of him. Right? In every situation when a devotee is in trouble, that's the point at which Krishna never delegates. He's always there himself. Right? This is the special quality of Krishna. Right? Is that he's always there. In this way he's achyuta, he's infallible. Right? Because he never fails when it comes to taking care of his devotees. He promises so many times in Bhagavad Gita. He says, Kshipram bhavati dharmatma shashvat chantim nigachati Gaunteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashyati Ananyas chintayanto mam ye jana paryupasate Tesham nityabhiyuktanam yogakshema vahamyam. Again and again he's telling Arjun, name bhakta pranashyati, my devotee is never destroyed. You declare it to the world, my devotee is never destroyed. I'll carry what they lack, preserve what they have. Yoga kshema vaham yaham. He says, again he says at the end of Bhagavad Gita, sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha yishyami ma shucha. Don't worry, I'll take care of you. Don't fear. Tesham aham samuddharta mrityu samsara sagarat bhavami nachirat partha. He tells Arjuna again in the 12th chapter that for those devotees who are thinking of me with love, tesham aham samuddharta, I myself come and deliver them from the ocean of birth and death. Nachirat partha. It doesn't take me any time, not even a moment, and I'm there, he tells Arjun. And in the purport, Prabhupada quotes a verse from the Puranas in which Krishna says, Garuda skandham aropya. He comes on the back of Garuda himself just to protect the devotee. This happened again in the case of Gajendra. Right? He was not even human, just an elephant, an animal. Of course Krishna could have killed an alligator. Even the enemy was not a major demon per se. Think, okay, maybe for Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, the Lord has to come. But for an alligator? A crocodile? Of course Krishna can kill him. But no, it's the matter of my devotee, I have to come myself. Garuda skandam aropya. On the back of Garuda, the Lord comes to protect his devotees. This is the one task Krishna doesn't delegate. And this is what Bhishma Dev, he wanted to see on the battlefield. Right? When on that day when he sent volleys of arrows against Arjun, nearly killed Arjun, his fight was so strong. And Krishna, he had taken a vow, I will never fight in this battle. I will not pick up arms. And he couldn't handle it. He couldn't maintain it. When he saw Arjun in danger, he just ran off the chariot, jumped out, picked up a wheel, and ran towards Bhishma to kill him. And at that point, Bhishma said, come, kill me. I don't care. I don't mind being killed by you. The point was not to fight with you anyway. I just wanted to see how you're ready to do anything for your devotees. That's all I wanted to see. This is why I did it. I have no interest in killing you or Arjun. I don't want to fight with you. You're my Lord. Right? Come, kill me. That'll be the perfection of my life. But I just wanted to see how you're ready to do anything for your devotees. I wanted to prove that you can even break your promise when it comes to your devotees. That you're infallible, but only in this matter, that you never ever fail your devotees. So we should be confident that Krishna, he may delegate everything, but he will always have time for us. Right? Always. As long as we have time for Krishna. Right? It cannot be a one-way thing. Yes, you had a hand. Yes, please. Right. Okay, very good question. Excellent question. These two things are not mutually exclusive. Right? They're not like fire and water. In fact, the better example is like the root of the tree and the entire tree itself. Shishiradha Gopinath ki. That the Bhagavatam gives the example, just as when you water the root of the tree, then all the leaves are also fed with water. So when we have a relationship with Krishna, sometimes people, they have this fear that if I become too spiritual, then how will my material life go on? Right? People worry like this, that, okay, you know, agar har aadmi is dunya mein bhakt ban gaya, to dunya kaise chalegi? Kisi ko to kaam karna hai. Aap sab mat kaam karo, sab hari bhajan, hari Krishna karo. Lekin koi to dunya chalayega. So who will do this world's work? No. These two things, they're not mutually exclusive. In fact, if we focus on spiritual life, our material life will only go better. Right? It will only improve. Because what happens is materially we're stretched thin. We talked about that. 25% here, 25% there, 25% there. But Krishna, he's the only one who can cover everyone. So when we plug into Krishna's 100%, right, then also we are able to do everything ourselves. Because Krishna has that ability of being 100% for everyone. Right? So if we plug into Him, then everything and all our material commitments will also go very well. Now, Krishna, He will never ever penalize us for whatever time we spend in His service. He will never do, oh, okay, today you did 15 minutes extra chanting, now you watch what will happen at work. Your boss will get upset at you, you'll lose your job. Why will Krishna do that? He's so grateful for any time we spend towards Him. No, He helps. He'll always help. Whether it's a work or with study. Of course, this is a matter of faith. It takes time to build that faith. That if I give a little bit of extra for Krishna, then Krishna will take care of me. In the beginning, we're a little frightened. So that's natural. Right? We always have plan B in mind, right? In case Krishna doesn't work out, then what do I have? Just in case He's a little too busy to take care of me, I have to have some other backup plan. Yes, okay, we have that feeling inside us. That's natural. But gradually we can develop faith. How? By doing a little bit extra for Krishna. By doing something extra. this by stepping outside of our comfort zone for Krishna. That today, I'm not going to do too much. Maybe today, I'll do 15 minutes extra devotional service today. And you'll see, you do a little bit extra for Krishna, and Krishna will take care of your material life also. And when he does that, you'll feel, wow, Krishna is so nice. He took care of me. Let me do a little bit more. You'll do a little bit more for Krishna. And again, he'll take care of your material life. It'll go better. And again, your faith will increase. In this day, in this way, one day, right, we will all be able to give 100% to Krishna. And still, he will take care of all 100% for us. Right? Krishna, he feels, this person has given 100% for me, so I have to take care of 100% for him. Right? And in this way, our faith will increase, our Shraddha will increase. But we have to start in a small way. Right? A little by little by little. Right? We have to step out of our comfort zone for Krishna. Just every day think, how can I do something a little bit extra for Krishna today? Every day I do what I'm used to, right? I come on Sundays, I'll do a little service, I chant this many rounds every day. Today let me do a little bit extra and see what happens. You just see the results yourself. Krishna will reciprocate in such a wonderful way that you won't know how to give back to him. You won't know how to reciprocate. Right? This is the experience of every devotee in this world. You speak to any devotee, they'll tell you this. Krishna, he's so kind, he'll give so much to you that you won't know how to pay him back. You'll want to do something. This is the exchange of love between the Lord and his devotee. The devotee does something for Krishna. Krishna, he gives back lavishly. I'm saying not just materially. We shouldn't expect, okay, always it'll come in the form of money. No. He'll give back. In so many ways, he'll give back. Right? He'll give us happiness, satisfaction. That relationship will give us life. And we'll think, I have to do something more for Krishna. And you do more for Krishna. You try to give your best. And Krishna will give you so much that you'll feel that you gave nothing at all. And again, you'll try your best. In this way, the devotee is trying to sacrifice everything for Krishna. And Krishna, he's trying to sacrifice everything for the devotee. This is the exchange of love between the Lord and his devotee. We can experience that ourselves in our lives. But we have to start small. We start gradually. Some people know they can go a little faster. But it's okay. Even if you don't have that faith, try to do something extra for Krishna. And just watch how he reciprocates. If he doesn't, you can stop. There's no loss. Right? But I guarantee you, he will reciprocate in a way that no one can reciprocate in that way. Yes. Okay, this is kind of this the ultimate question, right? How can we actually develop that relationship with Krishna? How can we find that relationship with Krishna? The answer is actually quite straightforward. Just like we develop a relationship with anyone in this world, right? The process of developing a relationship is that we try to serve that person, right? Service is the key. If you want to develop a relationship with someone, perhaps a husband or a wife, then you do things for them, right? The husband serves the wife serves the husband. Perhaps you take that person out to dinner. Perhaps you cook for that person. Perhaps you remember their birthday and offer a gift. Why is the relationship between a mother and child so strong? Why is it one of the strongest relationships that we find in this world? Because no one serves the child like she does. For 9 months, she carries the child and suffers every kind of discomfort. Then again, the child is keeping up her up all night. She's changing diapers. She's doing all kinds of things. In this world, even if you paid someone, they wouldn't be willing to do that kind of labor that a mother does for a child. And as a result, the relationship between the mother and child is unmatched in this world. It's unmatched in its strength. If we want to develop a relationship with Krishna, then we have to serve him in that way also. This is the process of bhakti yoga. By all of our senses. Through the eyes, we come and we have darshan of the Lord. Through our tongue, we taste only Krishna prasad. And we only chant the holy name. We always try to talk of Krishna whenever possible. With our hands, we do some practical devotional service. Clean the temple, right? Distribute books, whatever we can do. With our legs, we visit the temple. We work for Krishna. we offer the fruits of our labor, our wealth, in the service of Krishna. With our intelligence, we study Bhagavad Gita. We try to understand Krishna. Every faculty we have, we use for Krishna. And you'll see, we develop a relationship with Krishna in no time. It'll start. It'll happen. Very, very quickly. Very soon. So this is a very nice, a very practical question. I think we're out of time. I'm sorry, there's so many hands. We cannot get to them. But thank you all very much for your attention. It's been a very, very wonderful pleasure speaking to all of you. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Radhika Raman Prabhu, for such a nice, thoughtful and involving presentation. We were there almost with you for every brainstorming session that you did. And I think the applause speaks a lot more than I could say. Thank you so much. Let us thank him from our hearts by loudly chanting.
Hari
Bol!
Hari Bol!
Hari
Bol! We have a couple of announcements, and before that, we would like to welcome special guests that we have with us here today. We have with us Mr. V. Ranganathan, retired IAS officer. He was secretary to the government of Maharashtra. Currently, he is the chief advisor for the Somaya Trust. We have with us Mr. and Mrs. Babu Rao. Mr. Babu Rao is the president for BJP in the Vidarbha region. Thank you very much. We have Mr. Vivek Katre. He is the judge in the Labor and Industrial Court at the Bandra Court. Thank you. We have with us Ms. Rama Mohan, director of the Times Foundation. ISKCON Youth Services, which organizes these festivals here, it is in collaboration with the Times Foundation. And they are always gracious. They spread news about this festival in their group of publications. So we are thankful for that. We have with us Mr. Hemant Taskar. He is the president of, of the Government Polytechnic College at Thane. He was the ex-director at the Technical Education Institute, Maharashtra. We have with us Mr. Jagdish Vora, chartered accountant and financial consultant. We have with us Dr. Amol Hude, lecturer in the Department of Pharmaceuticals at the Bharatiya Vidyapeeth in Navi Mumbai. We have with us Mr. Janak Bhatt, associate with A2B and Partners, one of the biggest solicitor firms in Bombay. And we have with us Dr. Richard Rodriguez, clinical hypnotherapist and post-life regressionist at the California Institute for Hypnosis. So we have an august assembly here. Let us welcome these guests also to our festival by loudly chanting,
Hari Bol!
Hari Bol!
Before we begin the next program, that is the Kirtan, just a few announcements. First is, we would like to establish new relationships with people who have come here for the first time. Yeah. So all those eager participants who have come to this Prerana festival for the first time, we request you to kindly stand up in your places. We can nicely welcome you. We also are looking for new relationships. Thank you so much for coming here. We'll welcome these guests also to our family by loudly chanting,
Hari Bol!
Thank you so much. Be seated.